I wore my my Washington State University College of Veterinary Medicine t-shirt. And my name is Leo Busted, and that's where I work, so that takes care of the introduction. Now tonight, we're going to talk about one of my favorite subjects, which has been variously called pet-facilitated therapy, PFT, or animal-facilitated therapy. And it's a hot subject right now throughout the world. There's some groups formed. They're trying to form one in the United States. I'm involved in one in the United Kingdom called the Pet People Bond. They had one meeting this year. And then they're having one in London in January to discuss this issue, and I hope to be there for that. And it relates to the utilization of animals in a lot of situations. And my premise is that to the extent that we as a people have been separated from animals, we are the poorer for it. And if one goes into very early times, what are the first things you see on the caves way back when? Well, they're animals, or they're people with animals. And in fact, there's a recent dig and a report in Nature out of Israel, and I think also in Iraq, of this, 13,000 years ago, 12 or 13,000 years ago, a man buried with his dog. Well, that predates about everything, I guess, relative to this relationship. And through history, animals have been utilized a great deal in therapy. I'm preparing some lectures now for the University of Minnesota for the Wesley Spink lectures in October, and one of the lectures deals with this. And in looking over the history of it, we find that the dogs were considered healing elements. The dog's tongue for a long time was considered a healing element. And if you recall in the Bible, it licked the sores of the poor man. So, but as far as recorded history goes, for this type of thing, I guess the first one that I've run across was at the York Retreat in the 1700s. Asylums and insane asylums and that kind of thing, they were utilized a great deal at that time, and they were very terrible experiences, really awful. And I think it was Richard Tukey, a member of a long-time Quaker family, realized that things shouldn't be handled the way they are. And so he set up what he called the York Retreat. And the York Retreat involved treating these people as people and those who were mentally disturbed. And they even, his wife had tea, and they would all dress up and come to tea. And they took much better care of them. And they had a physician who was very open-minded on this. And one of the very significant things that they did was to bring in some rabbits and chickens and other animals that they had these people to take care of. And it was highly successful. But nothing happened with it that we know about for a long time. But it's interesting that when I read the account of this, just within the last few months, I got some of the original documents describing this. And I made copies of them and sent them to Basel in Bielefeld, Germany, which is the most remarkable place I've ever been in my life. It started in 1867. And when people decided that attics and back rooms were not the appropriate place to keep the epileptics and the mentally retarded. And they set up this remarkable place where the door is never closed for anyone in need of help. And much of their approach is like they had at the York retreat. I don't know if they knew about that, but I sent them these documents, and I haven't heard back from them. But I thought the paradigm was very remarkable. And when I visited at Beitel just a year and a half ago, or maybe it'll be 2 years in October, I there were animals all over the place. On the farms, and of course there was a much association with animals. Now I'm going to show you a few of those. And I asked him, how long have you been using animals for your patients? And they said, well, it kind of got to them, you know. They sat there thinking a while. I guess we've used them since we started. But there is no record of it, you see. Nobody kept any record. Because it's one of those things that you know it works, so you do it. Huh? Just like eating lutefisk, you know it works. Well, when did it start? Well, so much of this in recorded history started there. And that's what we're going to discuss now for a few minutes with some slides. And then I'll we'll get to the American scene of what's going on here up until the present time, and then I'm going to tell you what my model is for a community such as ours in Pullman, and what it can do for the various institutions in each state, and I would hope that ours might be a paradigm for this type of thing. And if I forget, you ask me about also their use in for physical health of a person. There's some of you have probably read in the papers about those people who had heart attacks and they were greatly helped by this. And I'll also discuss that with you because her paper followed mine at the Petson Society meeting in Vancouver. So with that, I think that I will proceed. Oh. First of all, I told you that at 4 o'clock I was going to read you a letter, and the reason I didn't read it to you, I didn't have it along. I wonder if I got it along now. Maybe I haven't got it along now either. Yes. I'm going to take out about 5 minutes. I think I'll read it real fast just to show you what this can mean to a person. This girl, I have her tapes. As I told you, at 4 o'clock, she was raised at Pacific Palisades. I think her house was next door to Anthony Quinn's. And then her folks split up, and she was essentially felt rejected. After spending 7 years in 14 different institutions 36 times, I was released into society, which I was not prepared for. I was released not because I was any better, but because I learned from experience to keep everything to myself and by all means not to express my deep frustration and self-anger. In the early 60s, a person could be released from the institution if they learned not to make any waves on the ward. Since this really is a long story, I can't begin to tell you all the details of this letter. In this letter, but perhaps you will get a small understanding of what I went through when I was released from the institutions. I've never been an easy person to handle. In the institution, I was kept a great deal of the time in a straitjacket, tied or to a bed. I was seriously self-destructive, which stayed with me when I was on my own out in the world. I had no communication with people except writing notes when I needed to say something. I only went out in public after the sun went down, and for a long time I lived in abandoned buildings, rode in freight trains across the United States and was constantly picked up by the police and taken to the hospital for evaluation. It was a unique situation for my personality would change to a sick little girl when faced with any authority figures and would automatically change to an intelligent, somewhat stable person when faced with possible hospitalization. This frustrated the police since they couldn't understand why the doctors wouldn't commit this obviously sick girl. My pattern for drifting lasted for years after my release. I was a total loner and trusted no one. I was depressed most of the time and constantly did terrible self-destructive acts. I never went to high school, nor was I ever trained for any job. Many social welfare doctors' reports said that I was hopeless, needed a protective environment with someone doing my planning for me. I was a mess, and I really needed help, but I was stubborn enough and afraid enough not to allow any authority group to have any control over my life again. If I could help it, I wasn't about to let anyone lock me up, but I was so backwards that the future really didn't look very good to me. I decided that I wanted a dog, not just any dog, but one that would be a friend and one that would protect me. I wanted a special dog that was beautiful to look at. I went to a pet shop, bought a dog magazine, and wrote all over the country looking for that special dog from a German Shepherd kennel. I had no money and lived on the third floor in an apartment house. After waiting for weeks, I received a letter from a kennel in Texas with a picture of a female shepherd that was 10 months old, and her name was Joni. She was registered and out of Champion stock. The letter said that I could have Joni if I would pay for her shipping to California, where I lived. I was thrilled, to say the least. I went out and collected bottles to sell to get enough money for her. A policeman and woman drove me to the 100 miles round trip in the police car to pick up Joni from the airport. She was beautiful. From then on, Joni and I wandered the streets together. We would ride the freights, walk to the mountains, and be together 24 hours a day. Several changes happened after Joni came into my life. The police still stopped me wandering around, but Joni wouldn't let them near me. My personality would still change to the sick little girl, but since they had to talk to me for a length of time, my personality was able to change again to a more stable person when I didn't feel threatened by them anymore. This stopped the many trips to the hospitals. The police didn't want to mess with Joni, nor did they want to go through the problems of taking her away from me. Another change was the fact that since Joni was so beautiful, and because I'd learned to train her and she was a good performing dog, people used to come to me and talk to me about Joni. I never communicated with the everyday citizen before, staying mostly to the police. Even though I was afraid of them, I had a need to feel safe from the world. Joni gave me a chance to learn how to communicate. The more I knew about Joni and how to work her, the more people wanted to know about her. As time went on, other dogs came into my life. I'd moved to a small rundown house and lived very bad with never having the right food for me. The dogs ate excellent. I didn't have any sense of responsibility toward me, but I did for the dogs. They got their shots, and in any event, care was given, and I was paid a little at the time to pay when my welfare check would come every month. When Joni, Dina, Chief, and Sarge, all shepherds, that I had no home because our landlord sold the house, I would not give up my friends, so we started off across the United States on foot. These were all dogs, incidentally. She picked up some more. By freight train. For 4 months, we were on the road having a real hard time. Not them, but me, since it took all my energy to handle them all and find them food, since I had no money. We were on TV and radio and in the newspapers during this trip. Because I loved my animals deeply, I could not hold on to my dogs if I couldn't give them proper care. I couldn't keep them when I couldn't find housing, or there wasn't any food, or in my rundown condition, couldn't handle them. Joni went to her new home after I had her 3 years. All the other dogs went to their new homes too. They were always homes of people that had far more than I. They were people who had fenced yards and would give them lots of love. I never sold a dog. I couldn't sell a friend. It never failed, though, when I didn't have a dog, I would regress back near the original state of my mind, wandering the streets and being sent to the hospital. The more the dogs came into my life, the more lasting my progress became. The stories are many about my dogs. It's totally fascinating in how they would change my personality. I learned to be an excellent trainer of dogs. I became involved with dog shows, tracking dogs, protection dogs, all sorts of areas of dogs. But an interesting thing, a change happened. The more secure I became with my own self, the less I needed the big image dogs of the Doberman and the Shepherd. No longer did I need the dog to help me feel secure to walk down the street. It was a totally different task to learn to walk down the street with a little 5-pound dog that I got at the animal shelter just before he was going to be destroyed. His name is Billy, and he is a dog that needs to wear a sweater when it's cold out. Billy couldn't protect me from the environment, but I had to protect him. He needed me, whereas before I needed the big dogs. After this change to the little dogs, my life started coming together. My patterns changed with the police, self-destruction became a further part, and found another interest, photography. Now I'm a photographer, mostly a dog photographer. I've been published in 7 magazines with the latest article and photos being published in the President's Committee of Employment of the Handicapped magazine, Disabled USA. Probably some of you are familiar with that. The article, Walking Tall, Guide Dogs for the Blind People, was shot at the Guide Dogs for the Blind in San Rafael, which I told some of you about at 4 o'clock. A publisher in Virginia is interested in making my dog pictures into a calendar, and the American Kennel Club's editor-in-chief asked me to send my portfolio for possible assignment here on the West Coast. I'm under a two-month contract shooting pictures for the Department of Social and Health Service in Olympia, the capital of my state. What has my dogs given me? A purpose. They have shown me what it's like to love something. They have taught me what it's like to feel grief when they leave me. They have given me warmth when I was cold. Through my dogs, I saw myself at the dog shows that I shouldn't fear that everybody, every citizen, since they were just, some of them were just as screwed up as everyone else. The only difference, they have learned to control their behavior. There are thousands of disturbed people in the world, either institutions or out in society, who could benefit, as I did, having a pet, especially a dog, come into their life. There is so much potential in the area that I've been hoping people who are helping people who are in the getting to people who are in the policy makers would hopefully they will start looking at this. I gave the mental health department in our capital the many research papers you have written in hopes that it will help educate them to the benefits of pet therapy, especially in institutions under supervision. I believe that I could respond a lot earlier if I was allowed to be involved in an animal a long time when I was locked up. I believe that when a patient starts responding, that it's totally important to teach all aspects of animal care and show them how obedience can affect the dog's behavior. To get the patiently totally involved with the dog is important, very important. I could not make any change in my life until I was totally committed to Joni's welfare. I think it's great if the dog could reach those who are totally withdrawn into some catatonic shell, but I think it's even greater if the dog could bring someone further than anyone ever expected. Even though I'm still receiving federal aid to live, no one has known me for any length of time could ever imagine that I could come this far. I owe it to my dogs. This is one of the more remarkable letters I have ever seen. And I know Kathy now. She lives in Everett. And I met with her with a representative from mental health here in the state. And I also have a picture of Billy, but I really regret I didn't bring it along. And she's the one that has the two dogs that one of them leads the other one around on a leash. And they go through all kinds of tricks, walk on their back. They wear crazy clothes. And I may get back to her. She will be at our place here on the Thursday after I get back. She may be making some presentation. I of course would not present that letter if I had not had permission from her. This is a letter to an associate of mine, Dr. Corson at Ohio State University, which I'll refer to later. She has since sent me the tapes of her entire life, and we've had a lot of correspondence. So that serves to sort of introduce you to where I'm coming from in this business. Do you mind if I'll leave? Are the lights bothering you up above? Is this all right? The name is Sigmund, and the bill is $6 an hour. This is a picture for animal facilitated therapy. You see? Oh yes, I can lower that. Is that all right? That's about as long as I can get. Now this is this Betel in Bielefeld, Germany. They have, of course, many farms and all associated with Betel, and this happens to be out in the country. They have over 5,000 disadvantaged people there, and over 5,000 people who live with them and take care of them. It's an hour's ride by train south and west of Hanover in Bielefeld. It's a town of about 350,000. And then Bethel is one of the areas of the town. But they also have, you out of town, they have these. They have them in many places now. And here they have a lot of some lakes and streams there, and they always have these ducks, and there's probably one of the people who is handicapped feeding the animals. Here's a group of them out in the place where I was. I never had a warmer welcome from anybody than from these mentally retarded people here. They welcomed me like a long-lost brother. And the sorted birds. They also have a place for, they take in people of the way there. You call them bums. They call them people of the way. In fact, they even have a retirement home for them. And outside the retirement home, unfortunately, I don't have a picture of it. They have a large aviary of small birds where you can sit and watch the birds. I put in my request for a room there. Here's just another scene at one of the locations where I visited. More recently, they've gone into the utilization of horses in therapy. They have Welsh ponies there. It was determined just after the war, and when we had a lot of polio victims, they found out that physical therapy, of course, were very good for polio victims, but horseback riding was even better. And for epileptics, it improves the muscle and the balance. So this is found to be more therapeutic than just physical therapy. And so now they started that up in Norway and England first, utilizing this, and they call it riding for the handicap. And I'll tell you more about how we're into it. You have a very nice place over north of Seattle, Woodinville, is one of the really good places for this. And at Beitel, somebody gave enough money to build this stadium where you can do it all year round. And usually you'll have three people on this kind of a thing initially to get them used to sitting in it. Sometimes you have special equipment. This happens to be a child here. And you see there's an epileptic up there with his headgear. Do you see it? Here, I'll show you another one. See here, that's an epileptic, and you see, because when they have a fit, it'll protect their head, you see, and of course they're very eager about this, and they can do it summer and winter, and they really got some nice ponies for this. I wanted to get the horse into focus, but it won't get into focus. And this is at Beitostølen and the Valdres in Norway. They started there. There's a fellow named Erling Stordal, who's a blind musician in Norway. He's very well known throughout Norway. And he thought that it's called a sort of a sports place. I forgot the Norwegian name, but it's Beitostølen and Sportsplatz or something. But that sounds German, doesn't it? Well, anyway, they take blind people or any disadvantaged person, and they do a lot of physical therapy, a lot of swimming, but they also have dogs and horses. They teach blind people how to ski and how to ride horses, and so they're very much into the therapy. And here you see one of them there now. They have the group out with them, and they also have dogs that pull them in the snow. And so that's another very interesting place. And I'm very keen about this, and I'll tell you more about it. This happens to be the chief's aunt. She's a great person. She's dead now, died at 92. That's Aunt Vinnie. And there she is with her son's horse. She's 85 here, and the horse is comparable to 86-year-old person. So they kind of match up. But she's enjoying a ride at 85. Isn't that great? She's pretty happy there, too. She was one great person. Some of you from Seattle may have known her. She is one of the more remarkable persons I've ever met. Now we shift. So that's in brief some of the things that are happening in Europe. I already mentioned that they formed the Pet People Bond and are having another meeting looking at this. In the United States, The first record of any utilization of animals in therapy was, I think, at Pawling, New York, the American Red Cross, during the war, for victims of the war, for the Air Corps, set up this hospital where they did introduce dogs for therapy for the patients. And it, again, was very successful. But it was successful, and so what? Nothing really happened. It wasn't continued in any way. As far as used in clinical psychology, sort of the godfather there is a fellow named Boris Levinson at Yeshiva University. He was a clinical psychologist, and he always had a dog. And I really regret that the slides didn't arrive in time. I have a picture of Boris and his dog Jingles. I have trouble remembering people's names, but I usually remember dogs' names. And what happened with him, and this was, it was after the war, I guess in the 50s. And he always had his dog out at his office, but when it came time for the patients to come in, he'd always put the dog in the back room, put Jingles back there. He's kind of a collie type dog, a pretty dog. And And on this particular day, he had the dog and he was working on his chart. And the first appointment wasn't for a couple of hours. And suddenly this lady and her little boy showed up. And if you were this mother with this little boy, you would have showed up early too. He was a referral, and I mean a real tiger. And really distressed. The reason he got it, somebody else couldn't handle him. So he was referred to Boris Levinson. And they opened the door and they came in. And of course, Jingles went like kids and went over and started, licking old Johnny's face. And the mother was about to interrupt and break this combination up, but something clicked in old Boris Levinson's head, and he stopped her. And he let him go at it. And this dog, he felt, was the key for facilitating this child's therapy, so that he was back operating, I mean, a normal sort of a kid in a relatively short period of time. And that's when he started this. He's written two books now, but not organized studies, you see, not systematic study. But he has discovered and has utilized them a great deal, animals to help aphasic autistic children. And he's been exceedingly successful at this. And goes on and on some of what he's found. I think I can probably read you something he wrote. A pet is an island of sanity in what appears to be an insane world. Friendship retains its traditional values and securities in one's relationship with one's pet, whether a dog, cat, bird, fish, turtle, or what have you. One can rely upon the fact that one's pet will always remain faithful, intimate, non-competitive friend, regardless of the good or ill fortune life brings us. And I didn't mention this in our dog show today, but you see, that's a remarkable thing about a dog and these animals. They don't care if you're pretty or you're the most despicable-looking person in the world, or if you're dumb or smart or deformed or anything. You're the most important thing in the world. And even with Charlie and the chief, you know, the chief can go off, she maybe forgets to leave water for him, and she's gone for 3 hours beyond his regular feeding time. And when she comes to the door, comes home, does Charlie bite her? Well, I would, but Charlie doesn't, huh? Charlie is overjoyed to see her, huh? If she's gone for 5 minutes or 3 days, he's just as happy to see her. Well, that's the nature of these beasts. They're forgiving. See, they don't hold any grudges. And that's part of the key to this thing. Now Levinson made a plea. He made a plea that we should do some systematic studies on this. Because he had trouble. He'd stand up before a group of psychologists, clinical psychologists, and he'd report on his successes with the dogs, and they'd make snide remarks, wondering if he'd shared the fee with the dog, and you know, stuff like that. Well, so Corson is an interesting guy. He was thrown in jail at the age of 13 in Russia. He always believed in peace and nonviolence, but he got out of Russia when he was very young, worked his way through, Columbia or New York University. He was on the faculty at Yale for a while. He's been at Columbus, Ohio, in the Department of Psychiatry, although he's a PhD, he's a biophysicist, really. And his wife, I think, is a remarkable person. I've only talked to her by phone, but I've known Sam for a long time. And Sam started some systematic studies, although he isn't accepted so much at Ohio State University, but he's done some very interesting work. How he got into it was this. And I've told some of you this, I think, before. He was studying hyperkinetic dogs. Much of our studies in the animal world is to study them as models for the human disease. And you know hyperactive children, huh? Well, he had a model for hyperkinesis in a dog, and he and his wife were very busy studying these. And it was in a psychiatric hospital. And some of the patients heard the dogs barking, and they wondered why can't we go down there and play with them? And so they asked Corson, and he had enough to do with his hyperactive dogs. That was enough for him. And so at first he says no, he couldn't do that. And I have a sneaking suspicion his wife prevailed. And finally he relented and says, all right, we did, because he had these dogs that he was working on. They were really pegged well. he had them all well defined. They were kind of a Duke mixture. And so he got access to some of these patients then, some of the real dead-enders, like this girl here, or Sonny, who were there. They weren't responding to therapy. That's the ones he'd get, you know, the ones that weren't responding to therapy. And he would introduce a dog to them. And I remember, well, this girl, this is the dog they got for her. And she was really in bad shape. She wasn't responding to therapy, and within, I think, 6 weeks, she was back functioning, discharged. Sonny was laying in bed. He was 19 years old. He wasn't responding to anything, would hardly talk to anyone. And he was resisting any therapy. They had given him, I think, shock treatments, wasn't responding. And so they brought Arvin up there. Arvin is a wired terrier. And they're like some of you. They're aggressive lovers. And he jumped up on the bed and he licked Sonny. And then he jumped off the bed and went running down the aisle, and old Sonny jumped out of bed and chased him. That's the first time he'd been up in a long time. And within a couple of months, and he responded then to other therapy and was with it and was discharged within 2 months. He had about 49 out of 50 successes in this type of thing. He then ran out of money, and a very enlightened guy, he advertised on television, I guess, that came to attention that these dogs were having to be disposed of, and this guy down in Millersburg, Ohio, at the Castle Nursing Home, and he himself had a dog that he'd go around the retirement home and visit, and he realized their value, so he called up, of course, and he said, "I'll take your dogs," and he poured the cement pad on Friday, and put the cages up on Saturday and brought them in on Sunday, I think it was. And he found a great change in all these patients. Some of them, they had to keep them almost tied up, a couple of older women, because they'd be at each other's throat when they got next to each other. But never when the dog was present. They were civil when the dog was present. A lot of them, they'd take these dogs out for walks, and of course were far healthier, they took better care of themselves. And the most remarkable one was with an old man who had been there over 2 decades. He had fallen when he was in his late 50s, I think it was. And they thought that he was unable to talk. He'd just sort of grunt. And for 20 years, he'd been there and sort of grunting and really out of it. And they brought him a dog. And they understood what he said. He said, "You're a dog." And then he asked if he could keep it. And they arranged then that he'd have a dog every day. And he began tracing pictures of dogs, and then he started it in freehand, and if you went there today, well, he's dead now, but I'm getting a picture of he and Corson. And hopefully Elizabeth Corson. And hopefully some of these dog pictures will be on him. They were very, very good, and he started communicating with people. See, the tragedy of that, it was 20 years in coming. But a remarkable story, and I can go on and on. Many people become independent. They stay independent longer with an animal to take care of, because they have a responsibility, and it also cycles them into a schedule. But a lot of times when you're off schedule, you don't take good care of yourself, and they also tend to eat better. So these are some of the advantages of them. What else have I got? I'm supposed to say something there. Now, I want to bring up in one of the things I proposed quite a number of years ago, and others did too, is in institutional, in prisons and things like that. And this picture is to remind me to tell you about Lima, Ohio. It's the prison for the criminally insane. And sex offenders, I mean, they're really at the end of the line. I mean, really bad actors. And one day, many years ago, I think it was a sparrow or something, had probably been damaged and broken a wing and fell into the compound. And some of the patients secreted away and nursed it back to health. Well, there's a strict rule in most prisons that you can't have any livestock. But David Lee, who was the psychiatric social worker there, took the side of the patient. He says, why not let him keep them? What's wrong with it? And he pleaded with them, and they allowed it as they could keep it, and then he worked, so they got other ones. Other birds and creepy crawly things of various sorts, nothing bigger than, I don't know, maybe a gerbil or some of the big macaws and stuff. But it changed the whole tenor of that place. Let me just read you what one of the people there said. In the past, I never had that really deep down compassion type feeling for any kind of animal. As a boy, I used to go hunting quite a lot and shoot rabbits such as this. I never really even thought that they were animals. It was just something to do in the fall. Now, after seeing the birds and the guinea pigs and the hamsters and the gerbils and the rabbits, they had rabbits too, on the ward and coming close to them, you really understand the necessity of feeling for these animals and not harming them. It's really changed my attitude towards all animals in general. Now that's one of the patients there. And a lot of people, of course, worried, and this is very important. You have to be very careful and to instruct the staff and everyone relative to the placement of these, and then select your areas to place them, because some will, of course, destroy them. But at the time that David Lee wrote to me about a year ago about his experiences then for quite a while, they had never had any of their inmates ever damage an animal, except one. And that was they had a rule that you could never take an animal out when you were discharged. And this person couldn't bear to leave his bird. And so he made a little box for it and put it in his trunk and took it out, and it suffocated. There was one day that one of the inmates became violent in the day room, and he tore up the whole day room. I mean, utterly destroyed the day room, except for one thing, the fish tank and the table it was sitting on. But everything else went. So they had, as this person described, they had gained a great deal of compassion. And this also to remind you that there was another systematic study in this regard. It was done by there are two guys at Hull in England. They're psychologists, and what they did was to go out to an area of town where there was some old people living by themselves, and they collected up quite a number of them, and then the social worker and the psychologist went out there, and they got the cooperation of quite a few of them. And they broke them into three groups. Well, first into two groups, those who had TV and those who didn't have TV, because they thought that might figure into it. And then they broke each of those groups into three. And one out of each group that didn't have television and one that did have television, they didn't do anything for them. Just visited them once a month for 5 months. And in another group, they gave them begonias, or two groups, you see. Another group, they gave them a budgerigar. A Australian parrot, and then they first give them a kind of a questionnaire to fill out about just where they were coming from and their attitudes in life and everything, and then the social worker would go out there every month, and at the end of the 5 months, they give them a test again to see just where they were as a result of this experience, and begonias were slightly better than nothing at all. But the budgies won hands down. They were definitely improved relative to their outlook on life, their association with one another. Some of them, they had built fancy things and got stuff for their bird and became very, very, very much attached to them. One built a fantastic playground for his bird. And they'd buy special things for them. I think they all named them. The men all let theirs go out flying. Only one woman allowed hers out to fly. I don't know the significance of that. But they, after the 5 month study, some of them followed it up, and a lot of them after 18 months they still had their bird and were really tied up with a bird. So birds are also a great thing. Now, before I come to that, I want to tell you about a couple of other things. child abuse. American Humane Association is involved with animals and seeing that we take good care of animals. But also they're involved in child abuse, which is a very terrible thing that's happening in our society. And there was a recent study by a pediatrician in UCLA. And in this study, I think it was 80% of the child abusers never had any association with a pet. And in the control population for this study, only 4% of the child abusers, the people that had a pet were child abusers. A remarkable difference. When I gave a presentation one time in over in the coast, and I told something about animal facilitated therapy, and two of my friends were down talking afterwards, and they were talking about a mutual friend. One is a relative of one of them and a friend of another, and they couldn't determine. I mean, they were talking about this guy's cousin and her husband. They were alcoholics. And the subject of their conversation was that they couldn't understand how their daughter, who was now 12, how she could remain sane under these very trying conditions of having alcoholic parents. And they says, now we figured it out. Since you've given us this talk, they are convinced that it's this dog she has, which is keeping her sane. And having somebody to talk to and somebody that really loves her and is concerned about her. Now, I could go on and on about some of these things, but where does this put us? Well, I've given a lot of thought to this over a long period of time, and we have now formed what we call the Pet People Partnership in Pullman. The Pullman Pet People Partnership. It's really for that whole area. We started it in the College of Veterinary Medicine, and because there were a lot of students who were very interested in this, I started the students out many years ago. I tried to get the faculty to do it, and they didn't get around to doing it, so I got students going on it. And they teach a course at night. It's one of the better courses on the campus, I think. It's taught at night, non-credit course, costs you $10, and you get more material than that, and they even furnish you coffee and cookies for a number of sessions. I wanted the students to get used to teaching this and have appreciation for it. I help them just a little bit with it, but they're in charge of it, and they teach about selection of animals, but how the responsible pet care, because people are not, they don't know how to take care of pets today. In fact, when I get to be dictator, you're going to have a driver's test and a license to own an animal. You've got to be checked out. And we'll change things around. But they do this. And we're also interested in a petting zoo. I hope they've already started it by the time I get back. It's kind of a touchy subject. I don't know if any of you are cougars, but we used to have a cougar as a mascot. And the students decided that wasn't a very good idea. And what we're trying to do is to get some miniature goats into the cougar lair. And if things are working according to schedule, they may be already in there. We'll see. It was a kind of a touchy issue. And I may not have a job when I get back. What are the various aspects of this? Well, who else serves on it? The young lady who works over at the Paradise Villa, which is a convalescent home in Moscow, several years ago, after Corson visited us, this girl and others got a cat. We got a cat in the Paradise Villa. That's a cat, and it's one of these cats. It's been till it has kittens. You know, it's been her then, and she had kittens. So then the party became informal. But it took some doing to get this in there, and it changed again the complex of this place. Here's one of the kittens and one of the people, and there's Kathy. And she's the driving force there. And as a result of this now, they have other animals over there. You saw a picture earlier at 4 o'clock of Charlie. He was visiting over there. And they also have a farm day. And we bring some animals over. We haul them over in our ambulance. We have a large ambulance. We took a colt and a mother over there. They really like that, petting that. But the 4-H'ers bring, sometimes their cows in there and their pet sheep. And there's nothing better than that because they're all pets, you know. And most of these people in Paradise Valley, of course, a lot of them are old farmers. And boy, they really have a field day. And they bring farm equipment in. And that was just a few weeks ago we had that. And they really have a great day. Now, she's a member of our council. It's a representative from our own convalescent home in Pullman. And we are now broken the ice there, and we're looking at now the right kind of animal for there. There's a representative from the Epton Society for the Handicapped, and we're trying to start a riding for the handicapped program, but I'm extending it to also driving for the handicapped. Because I have I'll say more about that when I go along here a little bit. We'll take a couple other shots here. Here's the old mother cat. You see that happy lady there? Before, she was just sitting there looking out. And here's a bird with one of the fellows. He's sitting on his head. See it? Would it be better if I turn off this light? Could you see it better? Can you? And that's over in Paradise Villa, and they got a big tank with fish. And for some people, you see, that maybe not handle one, but they like to watch the fish. So they can be a real source of... And here, now this is an interesting story. This is a dog that belongs to... They also provide daycare for some people. And one of them is a quadriplegic who's very bitter about life. But they arranged to get him the only thing he wanted. He's very bitter, but the only thing he wanted was a dog. So this is his dog now. And he comes and he has this dog. He wouldn't let us picture him. But he pictured his dog, and he's just a pup now. He's a German Shepherd. And so the other patients also get a boot out of him, as you see. Here's Charlie. Is Charlie visiting one of his friends? Now, I'll tell you a little bit about hearing dog. I didn't tell you about Miss Christensen at 4 o'clock. I will tell you, they train hearing dogs at a couple of places. The leaders in this is American Humane Society in Englewood, Denver. And this is Ranger. Ranger is a Sheltie, sort of Border Collie cross. Very pleasant dog. And I went with Laura Ray, and the chief was along too, and another lady. And we went out to Gig Harbor about 56 hours after Ranger had been put in there, because Laura Ray has the dog in her house for a while after it's trained to get used to it. And then she flies it up and places it with, in this case, with Miss Christensen in the middle. Mrs. Christensen had raised a large family and always had somebody around the house. Her husband died not long ago. And she is deaf. So she got a hearing dog. There was, some company. Boy, I should tell you this. I'm ashamed of myself. I can't remember the company. I told you about another dog placed in Puyallup. That was the Cheney Foundation, Tacoma, supplied this. But this was a real estate firm or something in Tacoma that sponsored this, because it cost $2,500 to train one of these animals. And I didn't tell you today, on the guide dog, it's about $5,000. But old Ranger there is worth $2,500. And you see he's got an orange leash and an orange collar. That's the official collar and color for a hearing dog. And it's legal here in the state. It has the same rights as the white cane law of the hearing dog. And what we did here was we knocked on the door. And that's a good way to go someplace. You ring the doorbell. And we could hear the dog in there. He came to the door, and Laura was pretty sure that he knew that it was her, and I'm pretty sure he did too. And then he ran back and put his feet up on Mrs. Christensen. That's how he does it. You don't bark. No use teaching a dog how to bark when you can't hear him. Huh? So he doesn't bark. So he came, and then he brought Miss Christensen into the door. She opened the door and welcomed us, and we sat and gabbed, and he checked it all out, put his feet on us. And then we'd done a couple of studies, because this is part of the follow-up. So Mrs. Christensen then goes and lays on her bed, and then Laura plays her tape recorder for a smoke alarm. And an old Ranger, he's laying there near her bed. He takes two leaps and jumps right on top of her. That lets her know that she better get going and follow him.
And then he comes running out in the living room, jumps on top of me and jumps on the person with me. He was going to clear the house. And then we tried him out on the phone, but she on the telephone, because he's also trained to the telephone. And but she had a lousy tape recording of a phone. And it was interesting to watch old Ranger. You know, she was playing that tape recorder, and he looked there, and he looked up at the phone, and they weren't together, you see. You see, a dog, if you play C, you see, it'll be trained to C, but it won't respond to C sharp or C flat. I mean, they can really, they have good ears. And he knew somebody was pulling his leg. No way, huh? And then we asked Miss Christian some problems. She says, yes, he doesn't respond to alarm clock. So he says, well, let's see your alarm clock. Well, the bell was off it. It was just a buzzer. And the alarm just went off as a buzz. Well, he wasn't trained to a buzz. He was trained to a bell, see? But Laura had her alarm clock along, so she turned on the alarm clock, and boy, he was waking everybody up. So that's what he's trained for, and they'll extend this. Because one of her problems, because she drives a car, we were instructing her as how this can be extended on Ranger so that he can notify her. She almost got run over by a fire truck a few days before, because she can't hear it, you see. But he can hear it, and probably when we give her some instructions as to how she might extend this, because these dogs can really pick up on that. So that's what a hearing dog is. And why I tell you this is because I feel that our Pet People Partnership is a resource then. If we have anybody in the community who needs contact on hearing dog, if they need that, then we make the contact because we have the resources. We know how to get a hold of the guide dogs, and we have that, and we have some people in town who are 4-H'ers and who take care of the guide dogs. And Laura will be coming by to make a presentation to us soon. And that's this is the group that Kathy Quinn, whose letter I read to you, she'll come over and she'll bring her two dogs and put on a show. And what I'd really like to see is somebody like Kathy Quinn. I'd like to have the state hire her to go to the juvenile delinquent home or to various institutions that are state supported, and saying, here's what a dog can do for you, and she can take her dogs to, and you won't believe what they can do, and she can help them, and she can be a resource contact with us or somebody. Says, and here's your situation, here's the kind of animal you could use, you see, and help them with it. I've already suggested her, and she'd be seeing a sister, Jean, who's a Sisters of Mercy in Seattle, and they're looking at a hospice, and she's already got a golden retriever. Now Kathy could really help her with that because she's an expert dog trainer. And I feel that's a resource that I think every state ought to really consider and consider it seriously. And we also have members of the Aging Council in it. There we had a problem. And just a little thing like this, which I try to point out to people. A lot of times if you're a physician and you have a patient come to you, and their concern may not be so much for themselves, but one of the things you have to ask them, do you have a pet? Because if they're going to be hospitalized in an operation, you better arrange to have that animal taken care of, because they'll be worrying about that animal. And there'll be a poor surgical risk. You got to take care of them. And we are printing up some cards that says, if a person is run over or he goes to the hospital, there's a card there that says he has a pet at home. Otherwise, if he's living alone, you see, the dog isn't, or the animal isn't taken care of. And also notice on the window that there's an animal inside for firemen and things like that, see. So it's called a pet alert. And for old people, instructions as to how, if this person is living alone and that dog is very protective and then they're sick, what are you going to do about that, you know? And we also have somebody from the counseling center at the university. And she uses a dog in her counseling. And she is certain that she has better relationship with this patient with the dog there. And now and then her dog runs out into the waiting room in the counseling center. And I don't know if you've ever, I won't ask you if you've ever been in the waiting room of a counseling center. But you know, they're sitting there like this and, you know, kind of looking around. But there isn't much going on until the dog shows up. Then everybody starts talking. Maybe about the dog, but they start talking. I know a psychiatrist that he never had a, he didn't have a receptionist, But he had two Irish wolfhounds that were very gentle. And then the patient was just instructed to go down and sit in there. And then he'd watch them, see how they're related to the dogs. And if they were having a good time, he'd wait a little while before he had them in. And they were easier to get along with after he got in.
But,
and somebody also from the grade school, because we want to teach these children and relate to them. It's very important, I think, that you have exposure to a warm fuzzy early in life. And if you do, then you're more liable to also relate to them when you get old. And it's of great benefit. And this has been shown to be true. So we have somebody from the grade school there, and then we'll hopefully have our students to instruct them in selection of animals and everything. And we're working on, and I showed some of you the a selection criteria for an animal that is a it's a profile of their temperament. And I also, we're making out a psychiatrist and some behaviorists, clinical psychologists are working on a questionnaire for a person, so we can help sort of match them up, match up the kind of animal they should have for a given situation, and we'll be putting that in too. And I feel that's very needful, because you see, it isn't fair to put an animal with a flaky person and end up with a flaky animal and not much help for the person. It isn't fair to the animal, you see, and that's one of my concerns. And so what you want to do is figure out the situation and get a stable animal for that situation, but also have a basis for comparison, you see, that you're developing a scientific base so that you have a reference point. All right, I have this kind of this happens to be a, well, I won't show it to you now, but we did a temperament profile of the kind of dogs we were going to get to love everybody here, but keep the bears on the outside of the perimeter of this camp, see? And we actually made a profile at 4 o'clock today, or 4:50, of the characteristics of that animal that you would have here. Or if you want an animal for a given situation, or you let the person, like I had the chief fill out one of these for the kind of dog she'll want after Charlie dies. It happens to, I also had her do a profile of Charlie, and it's pretty close. But as you might suspect, but that's how we're looking at that kind of a thing, and we'll be discussing that at our People Pet Partnership. And I forgot to tell you, yeah, about this. Here's Bob Ewing. He was a quadriplegic. He's now a paraplegic. He's our sonographer. I hired him because I like the kid, but I also, and he hadn't been working since he broke his neck, and he's a bright guy and liked dogs, and I wanted to sensitize our faculty to the handicapped. You never know until you have a friend who's like this what the problems are. I won't go into all that now, because next week I may discuss the handicapped. But he and I are working on a system, and they're supposed to be trying to develop a system so that I can have an apparatus on the jog cart that we have for our horses, where it can secure his wheelchair into this jog cart so he can drive the horse on the jog cart around. He's very interested in driving a horse. And also I'd like to have one of these for old people so they can drive a horse after they can't drive a car anymore. This is a really terrible thing. There's 65 other things I'd like to tell you, but it's calling. Goats, when I get to be dictator, every kid will have a goat. Or a miniature pig. This is Martha. I always get a birth announcement from Martha. She's only 65 pounds. She had 5 in her litter last time. She's a real pet. Answers to her name from 100 yards. And some people are using monkeys, but I'm opposed to that. And now and then, animals also need therapy from another animal. And this is this goat adopted this colt, this filly whose mother rejected him. And they're great friends. She looks after him just like her own. And that's the way it is. There we are. That's it.